Great to have you with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we begin the show by talking about the book Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicine. Subtitle, Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. And we have the author with us, Nicholas Money, fungal biologist, science writer, professor at Miami University in Ohio. His other books include The Rise of Yeast, How the Sugar Fungus Shaped Civilization, and another book, The Selfish Ape, Human Nature and Our Path to Extinction. So as we talk with Nick, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about fungi? Let us know how you notice it in fungi in your life. Maybe you love fermented food, for example, or you've noticed mold growing on the side of your house or on your shower curtain. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Nick Money, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, hi, Larry. Thank you for the invitation.
Tell you what, if you look at a title like Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, it doesn't inspire a ton of confidence. But I tell you what, I read your book, and I was laughing at times. There are some great stories some almost mind-numbing numbers about fungi, and at all a very pleasant read. So thank you so much for writing it.
It's always important to remember that it's one of the things that the author has very little control over is the title of the book. So,
well, I tell you what, it's a dandy read. You've got an interesting relationship with fungi yourself.
Absolutely.
Talk about how it played a role in something that happened maybe during your childhood. You talk about that right off the bat.
Yeah. It's all about me, isn't it? No, but there is a little bit of autobiography here in the sense that I grew up in the United Kingdom. I suffered from very severe childhood asthma, and it was only much, much later in life that I understood that fungal spores, that when we inhale them from the surrounding air, that this is one of the major causes of asthma. And there's a lot of very good clinical data on this. In looking at children that suffer from asthma and other kinds of allergies, and boy, they react to the little proteins carried on the surface of fungal spores, and that's what was happening to me as a kid. So my relationship with fungi, well, everybody's relationship fungi, extends all the way from actually before birth, from the womb to the tomb when we're decomposed by fungi. So yeah, there you go.
So, and here you are, you're a mycologist. As a mycologist, there are some unexpected places you've been asked to share your expertise. You mentioned in the courtroom, and it took me a minute to think about it, but how does a mycologist wind up in a courtroom?
That's a good question. That actually takes me back to the issue of fungal spores that are in the air. There is so much interest in the home contamination by molds that grow after water damage and the potential threat that they pose to homeowners. And so indeed, over the years, I've worked as an expert witness. I've worked with attorneys handling these cases. So there are lawsuits against homeowners. There are lawsuits against all kinds of things, rental companies, insurance companies. So, yeah, it's a very complicated issue legally. Scientifically, it's actually relatively straightforward.
Yeah. Fungi, so what are fungi? We haven't even...
That's right. Yeah, what are fungi? So fungi they're microorganisms, and that doesn't seem to actually ring true when you think about something as big as a mushroom, obviously not microscopic, but most of the organism, or rather for most of its life cycle... That mushroom-forming fungus exists in the form of these microscopically thin filaments that grow in the soil, and that's the colony or mycelium that's formed by the fungus. And so they're microorganisms to begin with. What else? They've got cells that are a lot like us in the sense that humans and other animals, we've got complicated cells where our chromosomes are stuffed inside nuclei. And so fungi are like that, and the technical term or the biological term is eukaryotes. So they're eukaryotic microorganisms. And the other thing that we can add to that, so they're not bacteria. They're also not plants. They don't make their own food. Like us, they absorb their food from by digesting the materials produced by other organisms.
And the spores they produce, I read somewhere, and I'm not sure where, that fungi produce about 50 megatons of spores per year, if you think about it on a worldwide basis. And that would be the equivalent of about 500,000 blue whales, which is the largest animal in existence.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, some years ago, I worked with some of the students in my lab. We were working on some of these looking at these high concentrations of spores in the atmospheres. But that is an amazing truth. It seems to be that there are indeed these vast quantities cumulatively of fungal spores circulating around the planet 24/7. And so, in fact, they reach densities in some areas, perhaps over forests that are supporting very high lots and lots of fungi, high diversity above grasslands, where they might even have an effect upon weather patterns.
God, it's amazing. You know, and I can think of some very highly regarded, you mentioned mushrooms, very highly regarded mushrooms, fungi like morel mushrooms. We're getting into the morel season here in Wisconsin. There are also some despised fungi like mold on food. How do you characterize the relationship between fungi and us humans?
Well, it's lifelong.
Yeah?
It's lifelong. It's unavoidable. So whether or not you go out and pick morels, you're going to be interacting with fungi every day of your life. And it's also really complicated. So we could talk about some of the fungi that actually grow on the body. So in the sense that even if you're not somebody that's interested in eating mushrooms or collecting them, hey, you're still interacting with them in a very intimate fashion all the time. They're moving through our digestive system. And this is part of the reason that I wanted to write this book. There has been so much concentration on, so much interest in, for good reason, in the microbiome that's dominated by these trillions of bacteria that move through the gut. But the fungi are really, really important in the health of our digestive system, too. And so that's part of what I'm doing in this book project.
And you do it very well. Well, you know, you do at one point in the book, fairly early, I think, as I remember it, you talk about conditions like ringworm and dandruff and athlete's foot, all caused by fungi. And let's talk about those conditions a bit. Ringworm, how long have we humans known about ringworm?
Yeah, ringworm's a really interesting story. So the fungus, there's actually a group of them that cause ringworm. I mean, they've been with us throughout our evolutionary history. And they're related. They're a fungi that cause athlete's foot. We're talking about skin infections here. And also, they've been with us since the get-go. What's fascinating there is if you look at where the greatest genetic diversity of these fungi exists, these fungi that infect the skin, and particularly the feet, the highest diversity is in Africa. Well, we see the same thing with human populations. So probably what happened is when we migrated from Africa to, you know, northern climates, we took the fungi with us. We started wearing shoes. We created a very unnatural environment by enclosing what we call the toe space in a closed shoe. It could be there that we'd really transformed these fungi that weren't causing any problems. They were just natural inhabitants. We call them commensals on the skin, and we turned them into a problem by changing the environment in which they were growing.
You know, dandruff, you write about what goes on your scalp, which was kind of amazing to read about, to be perfectly honest. There are plenty of yeast on our scalps, and they cause our heads to produce flakes.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? So in the area of a postage stamp, potentially there's millions of these fungi. Now, they're actually growing in the form of yeasts. So these are cells that produce buds on their surface. But they're all over the scalp, and they're feeding on the secretions on the scalp from our sebaceous glands. And yeah, indeed, if they grow in profusion, if they get too festive, this actually can exacerbate dandruff. And the best-selling dandruff shampoos contain antifungal agents. So if you're using, probably a product placement here,
Procter & Gamble,
Head & Shoulders, actually the best-selling shampoo in the world. It's got an antifungal agent, and that's how it's so effective at controlling dandruff.
But it comes back. I mean, the Head & Shoulders might get rid of it for a day.
Yeah, that's interesting. It seems that there are some European sources on this that say you're better off not washing your hair every day. You know, do it every few weeks and just use rainwater, and you'll never suffer from dandruff. But I'm not willing to try that experiment.
I'm not either. Well, you're right about that. We're always inhaling spores, and I think you say in the book, we come in contact with about a billion spores in our lungs when we inhale and exhale.
Huge numbers of spores. I mean, if you're outdoors, especially, I mean, probably every single inhalation and exhalation, fungal spores are moving in and out. And even though they're very, very tiny, our immune systems are reacting to them. And that's one of the ways in which we have this, I referred to it as an intimate relationship, but indeed it is with these microorganisms, these spores that are moving in and out of the lungs. We're also breathing them in through our noses. And of course, many of us are atopic. We're allergic to these spores, and they can cause, mentioned asthma, but also rhinitis, allergic rhinitis, another very common condition, and fungi play a role in that too.
Yeah. You say in the book, Roger Altunian, I believe, is your hero when it comes to
that. That's right. And I only learned about him fairly late in life, but yeah, he developed one of the best asthma medicines for controlling asthma that I actually was prescribed in Britain as a child, and it was very, very effective at actually dampening the symptoms of asthma. What's fascinating about this guy was a Syrian-born British immigrant. What's fascinating about him is that he was a severe asthmatic himself, and he carried out self-tests by inhaling different kinds of dusts to deliberately provoke really serious asthma attacks. I mean, he had to have a rescue medicine that he'd stab into his leg to bring him back from near death. An incredible story, but he absolute hero. And unfortunately, he died relatively young from the symptoms of asthma. It's fascinating guy.
Amazing story. Esty in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Esty. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. A friend watered my plants when I was away, my indoors plants. And when I came back, I found that she had watered them a little too much, and I had fungus gnats all over the house. And so I put a trap, which is basically a little cup with apple vinegar, and the gnats go there and find their death. But the interesting thing is that then each knot becomes a little circle of blue-gray mold. And unfortunately, I just dumped them in the toilet not that long, like an hour ago. So I would have sent you a photo, which you probably are aware what that is. But I've been wondering about these. They're really distinct circles, but they're all kind of stuck together. It's very interesting to look at that. So yeah. So if you can explain to me what's going on there.
Yeah.
I mean, so it tells you, I mean, just how many fungal spores are in the air, and particularly because your friend overwatered your plants maybe and really got them going. But those colonies then, they're formed from, I mentioned these microscopic filaments that spread out when a spore germinates. And so if you've got two or three spores maybe that land on a surface, they'll indeed grow together, but they always have that circular form because they grow outwards in all directions from that point source, that beginning, which is the spore, which is the sort of fungal equivalent of a seed. And you might not want to do this, but if you get a good hand lens magnifying loop and actually look at those little colonies, magnify it even 10, 15 times, they're gorgeous, they're beautiful. You can see these sparkling stalks and often multicolored. They're utterly, I find them inspiring. Well, I have for decades. Others might find them repulsive, but I love them.
Nicholas Money, our guest today, his book is titled Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. Questions or an experience to share, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Thanks so much for joining us on WPR. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Nicholas Money. Nick is the author of Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. And questions, you can, well, our lines are filling up here, but you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org for sure. Tim and Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Larry, it's a beautiful day today. I'm kind of curious how many spores are floating around out there. But my question has to do with in our homes, you know, like if you have a HEPA filter, you know, attached to your furnace filter, how does that clean out some of these spores that might be floating through your home?
Yeah, interesting. What do you think, Nick?
But that's a good question. It depends what kind of filter. The devil's in the details. But indeed, some of the stronger filters, higher rated filters, will indeed block a lot of the fungal spores. That the pore size, the holes in those filters are small enough that they trap the fungal spores, kind of like a coffee filter. The trouble is with those that if you install those on your, at least I found this in my home and at home in Ohio, the better the filter, the more restrictive the airflow. And so you're actually putting, giving you advice here, air conditioning advice here, HVAC advice. But indeed, you can have a really effective filter, but it might put a lot of strain on your HVAC system. But indeed, yeah, they are strong enough, or excuse me, the pore size is small enough to strain out a lot of the fungal spores.
There you go, Tim. Colette in Eagle River will give you a chance. Hi.
Hi. I live in Eagle River, and I really like looking at mushrooms and finding them out. And I'm wondering what you think of phone apps, because I use something called Picture Mushrooms. And, you know, it seems better than the book, because the books don't seem to, you know, they don't seem to ever have enough information or pictures, and it's hard to identify. And I've collected, not eaten, but collected and took pictures of like 384 different species up here between the different properties I have up here. And then if I do something that says it's edible and safe, I usually check it with other, not books, but usually other apps and double check in. What do you think of these apps?
So the apps are definitely getting better and better. That's absolutely the case. I'm kind of prevaricating here because I'm not going to advise anybody that isn't completely sure what they're picking to perhaps experiment with it, to actually eat it. But I mean, fungal identification in the field is very complicated. It's very difficult. I'm not very good at it at all. I've been more of a lab scientist than a field scientist, but I've certainly got colleagues that are just brilliant at this. Here we go. The best advice that I can give you is to get involved with a local group of mycologists. I know that there actually are a number in your state. And this is the best way to learn about fungi. Go and actually listen to some people that have been doing this for years. And, but,
and maybe go out in the field with them.
Absolutely. Go out and work, and there'll be presumably there'll be some of these events around the morel season that, as you said, is just coming up in the next few weeks. So yeah, that's my best advice. But I'm not going to knock the apps. Some of them are spectacular, and they work very well.
Yeah, and Colette, stay listening too, because Kevin Olson, who is with Northwoods Tea and Herb, based in Wausau, is going to be on after Nick is finished with us to talk about foraging. So he may have some additional. Kevin may have some additional comments as well. So stay listening. Paul in Darlington, we'll go to you. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Yeah, my question is on golden oyster mushrooms and how they've become invasive throughout Wisconsin, and I'm thinking other states as well. And whether you think if companies like the Field and Forest should be prohibited from selling golden oyster mushroom spore to customers?
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but I mean there are a number of mushrooms that appear to be invasive, so they've been brought in various ways. But I hadn't thought about that. The fact that if companies are actually growing these, cultivating them, that their spores indeed will become established and produce those mushrooms in a particular area. That's really interesting. You know, you've taught me something this morning. I wasn't aware of that. I'll have to look into that. Yeah.
Thank you, Paul, for calling. Appreciate it. Terry called, couldn't stay with us. She's wondering why toenail fungus is so hard to get rid of. Apparently, Terry has had experience with this.
Yeah, indeed. So when you've got a fungus that's established in the toenail, I mean, it's deep. It's deep within those tissues. Sometimes it's in the nail bed. So even if you're removing the damaged parts of the toenail, the fungus is still there. Very, very difficult to treat. A lot of the treatments, if you go see a podiatrist now to be treated for that kind of condition, often they'll actually talk about an oral medication. So it's an oral antifungal that you have to take for quite a long period of time. So your body's really suffused with this medicine, and it's destroying the fungi, and very effectively will destroy the fungi involved in a toenail infection. But of course, the side effects of taking a medicine like that you're changing the body's relationship with the fungi that grow naturally on it and actually are good for our health.
Speaking of medical, Bob and Adams is wondering about the efficacy of fruiting bodies versus mycelium in medical mushrooms.
Yeah, well, I'm a kind of a heretic in this area, or considered so, because I'm not a big fan of the medicinal mushroom business. I've written a lot about this as an academic rather than a popular science writer. But my it's always show me the evidence, and I don't see the evidence for most of these products really having any useful effects. But the question that's asked here about the difference between the mycelia and the fruit body is a really good one. It's one way in which often a consumer doesn't really know what they're getting if they're buying a mushroom product. Are they really getting a powder made from a dried mushroom, or are they getting powders produced by the mycelia, the feeding part of the fungus? There have actually been a few studies done that compare the amount of these possibly active compounds in the fruit body versus the mycelia. In some cases, they're pretty much the same. In others, there are profound differences. So it's just one of the ways in which it's really, really difficult to get at the question of, you know, are mushrooms medicinal? What are we really talking about? What kind of a product are we talking about?
I think you mentioned in the book that one of your papers to that effect resulted in the journal receiving the largest number of comments, a lot of them negative about what you
absolutely were absolutely. I was actually, I've been threatened with other lawsuits. I was threatened with a lawsuit over that one too, and it's downloaded. I get emails too to this day. Some are very positive, saying thank you for saying this. I mean, the article was called "Are Mushrooms Medicinal?" It was a short review article, a commentary, but my essential conclusion was no. And so I also got a lot of negative feedback on that one. But hey, this is the way that science works. Let's provoke debate, and over time, the truth will out.
Well, you know, here we are in Wisconsin, and you spend a chapter talking about how molds and mushrooms are in our diet, and at Wisconsin Public Radio, we need to talk about beer and cheese, which you certainly do in the book. Let's go back to this Austrian salt miner who lived 2,600 years ago. That's a wonderful story you tell in the book.
Yeah, so indeed, an Austrian salt miner a long, long time ago, and he left deposits in the mine, right? So he pooped in the mine, and some of that material's been collected, and of course it's after all this passage of time, it's almost rock hard and dried out. But using these amazing techniques of genetic amplification, DNA amplification, there's been some beautiful work done to figure out what his meal was. What was he eating? And indeed, what they found was that he had certainly eaten blue cheese, some kind of blue cheese, because the remnants of that were in this fecal sample that was found in the cave. It's absolutely astonishing. And they know it's blue cheese because there are particular fungi that are involved in that fermentation, that formation of wonderful flavors and the veins in blue cheese. And hey, that fungus was there in his feces, and it couldn't have got there any other way. This isn't something that's very common in the environment. And there's a suggestion. The evidence here isn't as strong, but they also found evidence of beer yeast, maybe. So I've got this idea of this ancient gourmand, right? And he's taking a break from hacking away at the rock face in the salt mine, and he's drinking beer and eating blue cheese. And you know, hats off to him. He was,
and he's to say, not so different from what a gourmand today might partake of.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I love that. How long ago did humans start harnessing the power of yeasts to make beer?
Yeah, well, we can't be sure, but probably a very, very long time ago, in the form of natural fermentations that they observed. So my guess is, I wrote about this in an earlier book, that palm wine, so produced from the sap from a tropical palm tree, was probably the first alcoholic beverage that was brewed and consumed by a human, or possibly even some human ancestor, some hominid ancestor, because this is a very sugar-rich product. It's very high nutritional value. And if it's left out in the sun, it will naturally ferment. Yeasts arise, begin that process of fermenting this, which includes eventually the production of alcohol. So they would have had, it probably would have produced a strength around about the strength of a bottled beer. But that was probably the first evidence of this. Goes back, well, a long time, thousands and thousands of years, at least, you know, pre-agricultural revolution, pre the formation of any sedentary living on farms. So you got to go back 10,000 years. You know, there's actually evidence from the archaeological evidence that humans or some hominid was actually working with maybe making sorghum beer. Well, in Mozambique, 100,000 years ago. It's incredible. Take a while to get to that story, but...
And it is an incredible story. And then to the cheese, you tell a great story. Well, there's a tale about a shepherd, I think, who was in a cave. Tell that story and what you think of it.
So... Yeah, if you think about some very different flavorful French cheeses that are actually grown or produced in caves, and how did that happen? And there's this story about this herder that left his milk curds in a cave. He ran off in search of a maiden. That's the way that they tell this story. And you know, he came back days or weeks later, and the flavor had changed. And he'd created the first of these incredible cave cheeses. And something like that may well have happened.
But that's not the way it works these days.
No, I mean, absolutely not. So it's a highly regulated process today. Nothing is left to chance. But, you know, if you buy Roquefort cheese or one of the other great French blue cheeses, yeah, these are well, essentially high-tech products today. But they have a reliable flavor.
Well, we can get into a lot of trouble with some of our fungi. You tell a story of, Sasha Elterman.
Oh, indeed.
A tennis player, and how that relates to, it's a great story within your book.
Yeah. So she was a young athlete that suffered a head injury. These were at some in Israel, actually, and she developed this very, very rare brain infection, and she was treated successfully. She was finally cured, but to begin with, this was just a medical mystery. They had essentially a bridge collapsed, and these young athletes fell into the water. Well, that water was contaminated with a particular fungus, a thing called Scedosporium, and you can think about that water being forced into the nasal passages, and you're pretty close to the brain if you get up there. So some of the athletes actually developed these terrible infections of their central nervous systems. And so I certainly talk in the book, there's a chapter there about these very, very serious fungal infections that are actually growing in frequency. I mean, there's a World Health Organization suggests maybe 1.5 million deaths per year from fungal infections now. So it's the yin and the yang of our relationship with the fungi. There's all these positive aspects to our relationship and all many different ways in which the fungi support our health, but also particularly when we're injured in some way, or probably more importantly, or definitely more importantly in terms of numbers, when our immune systems are damaged, then we become really vulnerable. We become vulnerable to serious fungal infections that are very difficult to treat.
Grant emailed us, can you discuss the relationship between brewers and bakers while using the same yeast to make their two products?
Yeah, it's a big topic. I mean, historically, the idea is that we Homo sapiens started off brewing beer rather than baking bread. And there's one idea. We get no real evidence for this, but there's an idea that maybe in somewhere like Egypt, for example, probably in Egypt, where they were brewing beer, that there was this, I'll call it cross contamination, and the yeast that were being used to brew beer, or the yeast that was being used to brew beer, found its way into some bread dough, and then we saw that they saw this miraculous leavening of the bread dough. And I mean, bread was eaten long before that, but it was unleavened bread. So yeah, that relationship and probably began then, and then probably more deliberate. Hey, we're going to take a scoop of this foam from the beer vat, and we'll use this with our bread dough to actually create this product. And you can see in Rome, in Roman history too, the I'm going to use the word rise here. I'm trying not to, but the rise in interest in risen bread, in leavened bread. I mean, it was a sort of seen as a rather rude confection early on, but it took off, and then the Romans are eating it.
And I want to go back to cheese for a minute too, because cheese it's a useful way to store milk in a fashion. You know, we didn't have, well, talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So why did we begin to experiment? Why did humans begin to experiment with cheese and yogurt and other products like that? Well, the issue probably is shelf life. But milk doesn't last for long, and it attracts the growth of some rather dangerous bacteria. But yeah, you produce a hard cheese, and that thing will last for a long time. So again, particularly in northern climates, if you wanted something that would travel well, That's the perhaps the birth of these fermented milk products, and also the advantage. This is a complicated issue too, but in terms of our widespread lactose intolerance, that actually cheese has, you know, lower levels of milk sugar and is actually, some people, you know, couldn't possibly drink milk, but they're okay with certain cheeses.
We have, there are several aspects of your book that we haven't discussed by any means, but that several historical events that kind of intrigue me. The Salem witch trials might be linked to fungi.
Possibly by, the exposure to a toxin produced by a fungus so the young women, well, and others in Salem were exposed perhaps to contaminated rye flour that contained these mycotoxins that was responsible for their aberrant behavior. So, yeah, rather than sort of demonic possession, it was fungal possession. But,
That rye business or grain business has, you talk about how that affected like whole communities or great parts of certain communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So huge in terms of, you know, you read the book and look at lots of examples of the historical impact of these, they're called mycotoxins on humans, but they're with us today. I mean, every day we're exposed to small quantities of mycotoxins. The USDA and the FDA, they regulate the amount of these toxins in our food, but we can't avoid them entirely. They're in really everything that we eat. They're certainly in all kinds of cereals, but they're also in the food chain. If you're a meat eater, or even if you eat farmed fish, there's mycotoxins in those foods too. So again, it's another example of our, you know, this clear, profound, deep relationship with mycology.
And we you mentioned this kind of right away in the beginning of our interview, but your final chapter is a wider look at how fungi affect our ecosystems and our earth. I was going to ask you, how important are fungi to life and death on Earth? I mean, we wouldn't be here if we didn't have fungi.
No. It's impossible, because through the relationships between fungi and plants, so first thing is they, as I say, they spin the carbon cycle, very, very important. We'd be up to our necks in debris, you know, if it weren't for the activities of these decomposer fungi. But then also through their mycorrhizal interactions with plants, with trees, but other plants too, that by supporting plant life, well, we're dependent upon botany, and botany is dependent upon mycology. So there you go. Yeah, we wouldn't be here without them for a number of reasons.
It's a fantastic book. I tell you, I interviewed Merlin Sheldrake. I don't know if you know
him.
Oh,
great. Absolutely.
Merlin said he was going to take one of his books, wet the pages of it, inject some, I think it was pleurotic mycelia, which would eat up the book and leave oyster mushrooms, and he was going to then eat the oyster mushrooms, so he would be eating his book.
Yep, very cool. He had photographs of the book covered in these oyster mushrooms afterwards, so it was a I don't know if he went on and ate them afterwards. Why not? So, yeah, good luck to him.
Well, I tell you what, your book is very engaging, and I learned an awful lot, and I'm really glad you wrote it, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much, Nick, for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Me too. It was a real pleasure talking to you and the people that phoned in. Fascinating questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it works. Nick Money, our guest today, and his book is titled Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, subtitle Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. It's fascinating and fun read, and you're going to enjoy it, that is for sure. Well, coming up, we're going to kind of continue on this path. I know mushrooms are going to come up for sure. We're going to talk about foraging to put great food on your table. Kevin Olson, our guest, coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. foraging can be a great way to get outdoors and put some food on the table. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. And we're going to be talking about foraging for your own wild herbs, your own mushrooms, and make some tea. Kevin Olson, our guest. He is a forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. His company is based in Wausau and, of course, has done a lot of foraging. And maybe you are a forager. Have you tried it? How do you ID the plants that you eat? Questions you have about safety and safely foraging for the first time, you can join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Kevin Olson, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in. We're having some problems reaching Kevin. I think we're having some technical problems. You know, that happens sometimes when we have guests on by phone or via some other method. Not the guest's fault. Typically, it's something in the air or something with our equipment. We'll get to him. We're trying to reach him right now, and we will get to him. I want to go back just to molds, mushrooms, and medicines for a bit because the mushroom part of Nick's book is really fascinating, and so I think it relates to a lot to the visit we're going to have with Kevin. I loved that part of Nick's book. And I think we're ready now with Kevin Olson. Kevin is, again, he's a forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. It's based in Wausau, and we're going to talk with him about foraging for some food for yourself. And you'll be able to join in, by the way. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Kevin Olson, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. We've got you. Thanks for joining in.
Good.
How'd you get into foraging?
I've been doing it pretty much my whole life. I lived across the street from the school forest when I was a kid, and I spent a lot of time in there. And then got into picking morels probably a little later, probably 15, 16. I had an uncle that gave me a field guide book, and then it just kind of went from there. And then we picked different mushrooms and then started picking different plants and then started drying them out, making teas out of them. My brother and I, and then I started my business and kind of went from there.
Yeah.
So it's
a long story because you've been doing it seemingly most of your life. Well, tell us, you founded Northwoods Tea and Herb. Tell us more about your business.
For my business, what I do is I sell wild harvested herbal tea, wholesale different herbs and mushrooms. I have a nursery where we sell cuttings for wild simulated cultivation for ginseng, elderberry, stuff like that. And we do like sub packing for other companies too. So, but for the most part, we sell wild harvested herbal tea, like chaga, elderberry, nettle, dandelion. We do like a mushroom coffee. Even do a hickory tea from the shagbark hickory tree. So all stuff from the woods that, you know, are good to, you know, for culinary, for tea, and also good for you.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the benefits a bit of these.
Every herb has a different benefit, or mushroom. But I think a lot of it can be verbatim. There's a lot of information out there. about it. But what I like to tell people is that, you know, people talk about Chinese medicine, you know, for thousands of years. They talk about Native American medicine and the history of that, but it's not often talked about some of the medicinal value plants that they brought over from Europe, you know, probably 280 years ago. So a lot of plants that you see or that we're harvesting, you know, they're not native, maybe not invasive, but they were brought here. Elderberry is one. Well, there's a native elderberry, but there was the black elderberry. I think it's Sambucus nigra that was brought from Europe, and it was used for medicinal value. Dandelion, there's different species, but the main one that we see in the fields, that one was brought over. Nettle, they brought, there's a native nettle, but they brought over a stinging nettle too. So the history of the medicinal part of it goes way back, and some of it is almost lost. Mullein, which is good for, you know, your lungs, and they used it for all kinds of different stuff, you know, hundreds of years ago. And then we kind of just lost. I mean, the information's still out there, but a lot of people don't know about that part of it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Jim from Oshkosh had called wondering about mushrooms here. The ones he calls puffballs are those circular white mushrooms that let out lots of spores if you squish them. There are some growing on his property in Oshkosh area. How many different kinds of these puffballs are there?
Well, I mean, puffballs, you know, really a common name. But they're, for what we're thinking about, there's a lot of different kinds. But the ones, the big white ones are the ones that people are using and they're eating. I personally, I was hoping nobody would ask that because I don't like that one. I hate that one. I think it tastes terrible and they go bad really quickly. But there are people that they really do like those because they're easy to identify. So as far as how many different species, I'm not sure in what realm on that. I'd say there's really just one main one that everybody is usually talking about, and there's stuff that kind of looks like it, but they're either not white or they're something a little different, I guess.
Yeah, these the puffballs that I'm familiar with are, you know, as white as a sheet of paper.
Yeah,
and pretty hard to miss what they are, and they can get pretty good size, like a giant softball at least, I think, but. So when you eat them, you don't like the taste.
No, I don't. And I think they go bad pretty quick too. So sometimes they look really good and you can cut them open and they're just the worst smell. And once you smell that one time, you don't really usually eat those anymore. So that's what happened to me. So if I see them, I don't even bother with them. But some people do like them, and they don't really, if they're in their prime, they don't, to me, have a lot of flavor anyway. So they can be pretty good if you cook them up in something, because they, you know, they'll take a lot of the flavor from, you know, whatever dish they're in. So
yeah,
good for texture. So.
Yeah, that there you go. Kent in Reedstown emailed us. He says, we've soaked charga, and it's a black liquid for a long time. Wonders if it spoils.
The chaga? They made a chaga extract, and you asked, when does it spoil?
He says, does it spoil?
Like anything, yeah. A lot of people, I guess in the rough form, once it's dried, it's good for a really long time. But like anything, you know, it'll degrade over time and get stale. But I wouldn't consider dry chaga to spoil. If you make an extract or a tea out of it, which is what most people do, they'll put it in their fridge for a week or so. But like anything, you know, once you make it into a form like a liquid, you've got to refrigerate it for a certain amount of time, otherwise it'll go bad.
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody getting sick off of any spoiled chaga in particular, I guess. So
there you go. Kevin Olson, our guest today, forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. It's based in Wausau, but he gets around a little bit. I'm going to ask him about him coming to Madison. He comes, I believe, at least once in a while to the events that are going on around here to sell things, to sell some of his products. And, of course, you can take your questions. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, and I've got many more questions for him, and I bet you do as well. We'll be back for those questions and answers right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Talking about edible wild plants on the program now. Larry Mueller here on WPR with my guest. Lucky to have Kevin Olson with us. Kevin's a forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. It's based in Wausau. And as we talk with Kevin, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about plant identification? Maybe you have a favorite plant you forage for. Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Paul in Darlington has a question for you, Kevin. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Kevin. My question is, I do a lot of foraging as well and morel hunting. I manage an 850-acre piece of land. But what I've found recently is, an elm tree, you know, when it's in its prime, where it should start to develop morels. I'm not finding morels, but what I'm getting is golden oyster mushrooms are taking over that property.
Oh, golden oysters, you're saying?
Do you feel that thing, the morel mushroom growing effects?
Okay, Paul, you were breaking up a little bit, but I think I have your question. You're finding a lot of golden oysters out in your property, and you're not finding the morels at least yet, and wondering if these are kind of an invasive mushroom, Kevin.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a cool topic that you could talk a lot about. So I guess the history of it, and I guess don't quote me too much on it, but rumor has it that it was grown somewhere, I think in Illinois, and it escaped captivity, and it's basically kind of run rampant. So I've seen a lot of it in the southern part of the state, and I haven't seen really any of it in the central part of the state. It almost seems like it kind of follows the line of the emerald ash borer, which is unique to me. I don't know if that has to do with like the tension zones that grow through the state, or if it's, you know, if that beetle has anything to do with moving it around. But it doesn't seem to spread as fast as it would in theory because it's spores and the wind. But there is a lot of it down there, and it's a really good one to eat. I like it because you can get a lot of it. And I sell mushrooms and plants for a living. So I actually really like that one because I can get a lot more golden oysters than I can with just regular your white ones. But I also pick a lot of morels myself, and I haven't seen any correlation with golden oysters and morels, and, you know, if they affect each other. I mean, morels are, you know, on the ground, a lot of them mycorrhizal, while, you know, your oysters are on a dead log. So, in fact, I kind of like it because if I see golden oysters, I usually find morels and vice versa. So I don't know if I call it invasive yet. I consider it more introduced. I haven't seen, and I don't want to ruffle any feathers because I'm sure people would disagree. But I mean, I don't see an issue. I see all our regular oysters with the golden oysters. It's just another mushroom in the woods. And it's here, so might as well use it. But I think maybe where the question comes from more is that people are finding less morels, and, you know, they're maybe looking for an answer why. And years ago, we found, when I was a kid, we had Dutch elm disease go through, and there was, the morels were just, which, you know, kills the elm trees, and morels and elms are kind of go hand in hand. And there were tons of morels for years, and then it kind of petered off, as we don't really have a lot of elms. And even my good spots that I go and harvest morels, I'm finding a lot of them under cottonwoods and dead and dying ash, but I don't find a lot of those really good prime dying elms. So I don't think there's any correlation between the two, but all I can say is that if you've got the golden oysters, you know, they're just as good, if not better, than morels, in my opinion. So
there you go, Paul. Well, Kristen Adams has a comment about morels. So let's
good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Actually, it's afternoon.
It is.
I picked a bunch of morels one year, and I took them home, and I did what you're supposed to do, which is cut them in half and make sure that they're clean on the inside. And I found a great big slug in one of them. So unless you're going after escargot before you cook them, you should cut them in half and wash them out.
good idea, isn't it, Kevin?
Well, I guess I have a slightly different take on it.
Okay.
So when I personally cook morels, I don't clean them that much. I mean, I try to keep the sand off of them while I pick them. And sometimes you get a little in there. I'll soak them. But a lot of times I dry them. So I don't eat a lot of fresh morels. I pretty much dry them all. And how I do that is I'll either get a screen if I'm at home, but if I'm out in the woods, or, you know, I'm camping or I'm in a hotel and I'm out picking morels, I'll get all my morels and I'll get like fishing line, like 30-pound test, you know, for like muskie. And I'll get a big needle, like a biggest needle you can get. And I'll run that line through all of the morels and I'll hang them up, kind of, if you can picture that. So they're almost like a clothesline, but there's a needle going through the stem of the mushroom. And I'll hang them up and I'll dry them. And I do that because two reasons. One, they last, so I can put them in soups. And I think once they're dried, they taste a little better to me when you reconstitute them and cook them anyway. But the other thing is the bugs, you know, they like that mushroom because it's a moist area. It's wet. It's what the right conditions. And when that starts to dry out, they don't like that. And a lot of those bugs, they'll bore themselves out or they'll leave on a lot of mushrooms. So if you get them when they're buggy, as we call it, dry them out, and you know, you might have to watch a little bit. I mean, a slug might not come out, but normally they'll leave, and then you can, you know, just go from there. So you can still use those morels that are getting on the backside and they're a little buggy. And plus, you know what, bugs, I don't think they're going to hurt you. And I've had people come up to, because I do farmers markets and stuff over the years, and they come up and they say, well, how do you know a bird didn't poop on it or there's not a bug in it? And it took me like 2 years of thinking about that. Like, how am I supposed to answer that? Because I really don't know. So now I just say, well, you know what? There might be. We don't charge extra for protein, you know. So they're not going to hurt you if they're in there anyway. But you can still use them. So that's my take on that.
All right. Thanks for very much for that question. By the way, here's a personal note. I was rummaging around in my cupboard, and I found, and this has got to be, some dried morel mushrooms that are kind of hermetically sealed in a bag that I forgot about. And that's got to be 3 years old. And I'm wondering if I could reconstitute them okay.
Well, I guess it really depends. I'm not sure if the health department's listening or not. I mean, I don't know the rules, but if it were me, I would use them. I think they're fine. I mean, when you get things in dried form like that, I dry a lot of stuff out, and a lot of wild ramps and mushrooms and all the plants that we can eat. And what I found over the years is that the longer that they sit, because I've got stuff that's been dried out 5, 6, 8, 10 years ago. You know, I don't sell it, but you find it sometimes in your cupboard or whatever, like you're saying. But The only difference that I found is that it might lose some of its flavor just because it's just getting kind of stale. Yeah. But that's not gonna hurt anybody. I'd eat them. And if you don't, I'm sure there's other people that probably will take them from you. So
I'll probably wind up putting them in a soup.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah, that's what's going to happen to those morels, because I hate to waste them. I was kicking myself when I found them because I just had forgotten I had them. A listener emailed us, can you discuss your favorite foraged plants for tea? And by the way, says, hey, great discussion. So thank you for that.
Boy, that's a hard one. I have a lot of favorites. I mean, elderberry, I spend a lot of time with that one. I love that one. It makes a good tea. I like sumac, your staghorn sumac, which you see on the side of the highways. That's a really cool one. I mean, they use that as a spice. I believe some guy came up to me at a farmer's market, and a really old guy is like, that's the original pink lemonade. And I was like, yeah, I don't know about that. And I looked it up, and there definitely is some sources out there that say that it is. So, and then it also makes a really good hot tea. So I like, you know, the plants and different, I guess, any flora that has multiple uses like that. So I think sumac is one of my more favorite ones. But I mean, that could talk for days about, but for drying out and using for teas, I think, yeah,
mint. Those are your favorites.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Cody emailed us, well, this is back to morels for a minute. He says, many times you will not find morels under dead elms with oysters on the tree, as the morel flush is usually only the first 3 years, and the oysters don't get growing on the dead elms until they are 2 to 3 years old.
Yeah, that's true, but there's a lot of other trees around those trees. So, I mean, you get into a woods where there, you know, there's a mix of dead and living and everything in between. And just, I guess, anecdotally, I mean, I've found a lot of them together, not on the same within 6 inches, but if I see golden oysters, it just seems like the right kind of forest, the right kind of area to go and check. And I've usually been fairly successful, but I mean, there's a lot of arbitrary stuff about that. I mean, and how everybody hunts for them is totally different. So,
yeah. Well, one favorite spot, which I'm not going to tell you exactly where it is, but there is, every year that I have gone into this woods and by actually some oak trees, I find in this one spot, for some reason, there's always morels, and they're around oak trees.
Right, and you can. I found them under all kinds of different trees, and I spent a couple of years trying to figure out why. And I don't know, but I do know that there's a lot of newer research that they've been doing, especially even in Wisconsin. There's a few people that really get into mycology, and they're finding, you know, that there are a lot of different species of morels, and to us they look the same, but some of them are, they look the same, but they're like a little subspecies to a degree that grows in a different area. So like, I guess to try to explain that, down south in the south western part of the state, I look for different habitats and different trees for morels than I do in, say, Eagle River. Where a lot of times in Eagle River, we're looking under popple, a lot of popple trees, and that's where we tend to find them. And I guess it's because they're slightly different species. I mean, I don't know enough about that to really go into great detail, but you do find them under all kinds of different places, and it depends where you're at.
Yeah, orchards too. People find them in orchards all the time.
Right.
That reminds me. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I said, but you can't beat like southwestern part of the state. I mean, they just, we can go down there, we can find a bushel of them, and they're bigger than your hand. Where, you know, up north, it's, we can find a couple here and there, but it's tough. That just isn't right for them. So,
Yeah, so it's an issue. And in the CETA email, let's just back to the white puffballs. And she mentions that some get as big as a soccer ball, and she's right. But she says Anne's mother would pick the smaller ones when they were still snow white. She'd slice them about an inch thick, dip them in egg and breadcrumb, and then fry them in butter. And they were delicious. Of course, you can fry pretty much anything in butter, and it's going to be delicious.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. I mean, I probably would eat them then. But, yeah, I mean, if you have to do that.
Megan emailed us. She's wondering how to introduce foraging to children safely. She's actually written a few books on this subject for kids and parents, and I hope she's giving safe information. But how do you introduce foraging to children safely?
For kids, I think as far as the safety part, I mean, you should know, you know, more than them probably, and you should probably watch them. But there's a lot of the plants and mushrooms, and I say this with caution, most of them are pretty safe. Even the ones they say are poisonous are usually, you know, you really got to eat them. And even sometimes, a lot of times, it's not going to hurt you that bad. So I guess what I should rephrase that as, it's not as dangerous going out there as people think. I mean, you should know the ones that are poisonous and be educated before you take, you know, any kids or anybody out. But I think it's important to get them out there because, like, I'll go back just shortly. So I grew up across from the school forest, and, like, I think a year ago they clear cut it. So they cut it all down. So I went over to their parents' house for Christmas, and I said, well, they cut the – why would they do that? And it was like, well, I guess they're not teaching the kids about ecology anymore. So my reason I'm saying that is because I like getting people into foraging, especially kids and anybody, because the more people get into it, the more they're going to care about it, you know, and that's the most important thing. If we're using those things and kids are getting interested in it, you know, maybe they'll help protect it, you know. So, but as far as the safety part, I think just have to get educated and know what you're looking at. And
I'm sorry, yeah, to hear about the school forest. I mean, have you seen an interest in foraging change over time? Is it more? Are there, yeah, more? Or are there? What do you think?
There's a lot more, and I would attribute that to just there's more information out there. There's a lot of there's apps that people are using. I don't always think they're very accurate. But they can be more confident at what they're looking at. Because it's like learning your flora and fungi is like a different language. And, you know, if you can be confident with an app or you can take a picture of it and upload it to, like, iNaturalist, and you know that, oh, that's a ramp. It's not a, you know, iris or something like that. So you know that you're confident, then that's what's – so there's more of an interest, and people like to be connected to nature, and there's more people getting into it, but especially because it's easier to go out and identify those. And there's more groups out there guiding people out there. So I think those couple things are making it more popular.
What do you think are there, you know, you want to be an, let me call it ethical forager.
Mm-hmm.
You want to? What are the responsibilities of an ethical forager?
Well, that's where it gets complicated. First, just the thought of that is good. You know, people should know what they're doing, and constantly, you know, go back to it and look at what they're doing. Example, back, you know, 100 years ago or so, they cut down all the virgin forest, and they teach that in school, that they did that and it was bad, but they don't always, you know, get to the point of how did it happen? Are they just that careless? But I don't think so. I think that they thought that it would take a lot of people, a lot of, you know, a couple lifetimes to cut all the virgin forest down. So it wasn't a concern, but it still happened. So you look at that and think that, you know, sometimes if you are just taking one leaf of a plant or you're just taking a couple, you have to think about how that affects the ecology and everything else. So It's very important, and I'm a big advocate for sustainable harvesting. And I do I'm 7 years into a wild ramp research project where I have grids out there. We harvest them different ways and see how they come back, how fast they come back, and find out how can we commercially harvest this without, you know, getting, you know, losing them, or how can we do it sustainably. So there's a lot, and I think if anybody doesn't know that, or doesn't know how, or how they're affecting the ecosystem when they're out harvesting or foraging, they should get in touch with people that are doing it, or get into a club or a group and be aware of what they're doing and their actions.
Yeah.
So very important.
Jill's wondering, do you ever freeze mushroom, or can you freeze mushrooms and get anything sort of out of that?
Yeah. So, for example, like, we call it shrimp of the woods. I think it's like a Bordedanthobola, or I'm probably not pronouncing it right, but it's a fall mushroom, and it's really good. It only comes off for like a week or two, and I've tried a lot of different ways. So what we do, and with that one, and probably all the other ones, is you cook it, fry it up in butter, like the one lady said. You could do that, I guess, and then freeze it. So just freezing them in the hole like that, they just don't, they're not good when you thaw them out. But if you cook them and then freeze them after they're cooked, I found they're fine. That's what I would do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Usually most of those things, if you cook them first, that works with sweet corn and a whole bunch of other things as well. So very good point. Are you going to be at the Madison Farmers Market this year?
Yeah. Yep. Go down there. I think it starts this Saturday, actually.
Yeah.
That's the first one. And there's a lot of people there. And if you get there early, you're going to get a lot more stuff because they run out. But I do that one almost every Saturday. And it'll be a couple weeks, and I'll have ramps down there and mushrooms if we get them. And I'll be selling all my herbal tea and mushroom coffee and all that stuff. So.
Oh, mushroom coffee. That sounds good, Kevin. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to seeing you at least I will, at the farmer's market. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Yep, thanks.
Kevin Olson, forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. They're based in Wausau, but he gets around to the farmers markets and other places as well. But the name of the business, Northwoods Tea and Herb in Wausau. Well, tomorrow on the show, Chad Spate's back to talk about home improvement, some tips on starting and finishing a home remodel project. That and more, that's at 11 tomorrow. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.